there's a certain point, usually towards the end of training, where you look around and you say to yourself, how the hell did I get to be here surrounded by these rock stars? You're constantly looking to surround yourself with people who are better than you, not from a self-deprecating standpoint, but from a standpoint that says, hey, this is going to allow me to step up. The problem was we weren't effectively explaining why guys were training. You know, we were hanging our hats on excuses. In an unknown environment, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to apply a known skill. So this is when we begin to lean on our attributes. Attributes are innate. I looked at my career and I had done hundreds of combat missions overseas and I'd done thousands of training evolutions. Never on one of them did I carry a boat on my head or a 300-pound telephone pole, right? They were basically putting us into situations to tease out innate qualities inherent to our being that told them if we had what it took to be SEALs. Before you tattoo anything, consider this. I think ego gets a bad rap. The military holistically makes the mistake of telling future officers that they are going to be leaders, okay? No, that's incorrect. They are going to be in charge. It's up to that individual as to whether or not they are going to behave in a way that allows people to think of them as leaders.
I am extremely excited today to bring to the podcast a fellow SEAL, accomplished author, leadership expert who's worked with the likes of Simon Sinek, author of the book The Attributes, which was a super compelling read for someone who has shared a little bit of Rich's background. Rich DeVinny, welcome to the Warrior Poet Podcast.
Thank you, my friend. It's good to be here. It's good to be chatting.
Absolutely. Can you, before we get into the book, I've got a zillion questions. Masterfully written, first of all, the amount of wisdom and what I think, hopefully you would say the same thing, but what I think are very unique insights and takes that are unique on older concepts as well. So extremely well done. We could nerd out about that for 3 hours. Our listeners, and we don't have the time for that right now, but we'd love to take a step back first and understand your origin story. You talk a little bit about it in the book, but for those who haven't read it yet, where did you get your start? How did you make it to the SEAL teams? And what has that journey been like afterwards?
Yeah, I grew up in Connecticut and had no clue who or what the Navy SEALs were. I actually, you know, I wanted to be a Navy pilot. My dad was a private pilot, so he used to take us flying, and my twin brother and I were like, okay, we want to fly jets. And of course, the two choices that we knew of were Air Force and Navy. We lived in Connecticut on the water, and I loved the ocean. I was just a water rat, so I was like, okay, well, the Navy's on the water. You get to land planes on ships. I mean, what's cooler than that, right? So we were hell-bent on being Navy pilots, and it wasn't until the first Gulf War, and I think you and I chatted about this, but a Newsweek article came out just kind of outlining the Spec Ops forces for all the different services. But it was unique to me because it had a bunch of pictures of guys in different environments, and like the predominance of the pictures were SEALs. And I was like, man, these guys are everywhere, the sea, air, land thing. But plus, they were from the water. I was like, they made the water their safe place. And that was pretty awesome to me. And so I really started considering it. Ended up at a ROTC program at Purdue, and ultimately just said to myself, I didn't want to be in the cockpit of my jet and wonder if I could be a SEAL. So I figured I'd try it. And it turned out, you know, it went great. I went in 96, class 210, served for 20 years, and obviously a very kinetic period, which you and I both experienced. But during that 20 years, got to run training, not the basic training, but training at one of our specialized commands. But it really began to give me insights and really a fascination with behavior, human behavior, and why and how we do what we do. And part of that just came from my task of having to deconstruct it for this selection process. But when I retired, which was really the last day of 2016, you know, December 31st, I began speaking and teaching leadership and talking about high-performing teams, and organizations kept on coming up to me and saying, hey, Rich, you know, we're building dream teams, best person here, best graphics designer, best marketing person, best people, right? And things go great for a little while, but as soon as the environment turns uncertain or things don't go the way we had planned or whatever, the teams start to turn toxic. They start to fall apart. What's going on? And just based on the experience, and I know we'll talk about this, you know, as we get into it, but I said, well, it's because you're picking your teams based on the wrong things, you know, the wrong criteria. And I really started thinking about it deeply. I said, you know, and I kind of researched it a little bit. I said, someone should write a book on this stuff. And there was nothing out there. I said, well, maybe I will. And so I wrote the book, and here we are. Get to speak with fine fellow brothers like you. So
thank you for the backstory. I love that. And there seems to be a common thread in startup founders. I've got a lot of experience in the technology world, post teams. And it's kind of that story of looking around and did someone do this yet? Well, no, I guess it's up to me to do it. So kudos for that. A couple things you said there already are sparking questions in my mind. Before we get into what are the attributes, how do we break them down, that sort of stuff. And I'd love it if you had a mnemonic for all 25, I'm trying to keep them all in my head at once. How do you think about growth mindset? You definitely give credit to that. I don't know in name necessarily, but you give credit to that concept in the book throughout in terms of people being able to work on their attributes. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about that, how you thought about it in the military, how you think about it or recommend to leaders in the corporate sphere? Because the anecdote of Julie, or I can't remember what her name was, the example you gave early on in the book.
Yeah.
There's this tension between picking people and screening people versus, you know, what I think we all know and love as military leaders, which is taking folks who have the right stuff in at the core, but then coaching them to develop as they can best contribute.
Growth mindset is funny because it's become this kind of huge thing, and almost more than Carol Dweck's original concept. You know, of course, you know, she wrote brilliantly about several years ago. But this idea, really, in a broad sense, that we look to the process and to achieve growth versus the outcome. You know, versus we're focused in on the actual outcome. And ultimately this is life, right? I mean, you can't grow, you can't develop, you can't become something better without struggle. I mean, that's just the way it's just the way it is, you know. So to adopt that mentality, I think is I mean, certainly quite necessary. But I think, you know, guys like us, what I realize, and you're going to laugh when I say this, is that when I got to, first of all, we go to Buds, anybody, they go to SEAL training and they're like, okay, I wonder if I can do it. And you throw yourself into it and you start doing it, right? And there's a certain point, usually towards the end of training, where you look around and you say to yourself, how the hell did I get to be here surrounded by these rock stars, right? You feel like you are just inherently surrounded by people way better than you. And what's interesting is that when you start to become friends and really brothers with these guys, you realize that they think the same thing you do, right? And I feel like that this is kind of something that can be almost habitual. It certainly has been habitual in my life. I felt it through my entire career, the teams, every single command I went to, platoon I got into, troop I led. I remember even taking over as commanding officer. And I happened to be kind of the one of the first kind of 96 grads out of my year group who was a CO. And so I was sitting at the table, around a table at one of our meetings with the Commodore, with all the other COs. And I was sitting myself saying, man, I don't know if I'm ready to be here. I was just surrounded by these, and it kind of got me excited. So I think growth mindset ultimately for me is this idea that you're constantly looking to surround yourself with people who are better than you, not from a self-deprecating standpoint, but from a standpoint that says, hey, this is going to allow me to step up. It's going to cause me to push myself and become better. So I think that's how I define it. And I think that's the arc, I think, of most SEAL careers.
Yeah. Not to take away from Angela, sorry, I'm screwing it up. Yeah, Carol Dweck and Angela Duckworth. But sometimes just putting a name on something helps people frame it in their mind. And one other thing, additional concept that struck me as you're explaining there is the concept of imposter syndrome, which regardless of when the term was invented, it's obviously become more prevalent in our culture today in terms of consciousness about it. And hopefully that's helped people deal with that. But Will Branham was on the podcast several weeks ago and was very open about his struggles with imposter syndrome in the military and post-military, with that anecdote of looking around after Hell Week and seeing all the rock stars around you. There can be a little bit of that imposter syndrome. I think all of us struggle with it at different periods of life. How have you tackled that? How do you think about it, given all the great thinking you've done about what the right stuff is?
Yeah, I think imposter syndrome, it adds one more element to the equation that we just talked about in terms of this desire to surround yourself with other people or people who are better than you. It adds this equation that you, every ounce of your being does not want to come across as a fraud, right? And part of you is afraid in some cases, that in some situations, that you may look like a fraud. And so it drives you to not be a fraud. I think and it's funny, people might think about this and say, well, how, you're a Navy SEAL, you know, actively like going deploying and going to combat and stuff. How could you ever think of yourself as a fraud, right? But I think just that idea is, it's almost this idea that, hey, even though I might be pretty good at what I do, there's always stuff to learn. There's always stuff I need to be thinking through. There's always stuff that I know I'm lazy about that I need to overcome my laziness for. So I think it's a check. It's a complacency check for ourselves in terms of performance.
I love that, using it as a tool for performance and looking at it that way. Yeah, I think about all those situations on deployment or beforehand, you know, all the extra gear checks. Like, I don't want to be that guy who, you know, left that key piece of gear behind. Help us think about, for those who haven't read the book yet, again, highly recommend they go out and get it right away. I read it cover to cover in about 2 days. Talk about where you started. What's the sausage making to come up with this? Obviously, you've got a career in the military, ROTC before that, lots of thinking about leadership, work after the military. How did you decide to break them down that way? How can we remember them easily? Yeah. And which ones didn't make the cut?
Yeah. Okay. Well, so we'll start at the beginning, right? In the beginning, it is about performance. And ultimately what I found when I took over this training department, this assessment selection program for this specialized command, was that we were in a position where, and I know you know this, but for your audience, this particular command took very experienced spec operator SEALs. It took them in and put them through this own unique selection process, right? And by experienced SEALs, it's like no one there, that you had to have spent at least 5 years as an active SEAL and had to have stellar reviews and things like that to even apply, right? I had been a SEAL for 9 years, right? So you had to already be kind of at the top of your game to even apply. And we put them through our own selection process, and we were getting about a 50% attrition. Now, again, that's okay. Any selection process the point of a selection process is attrition. However, the problem was we weren't effectively explaining why guys were attriting. You know, we were hanging our hats on excuses like, well, they couldn't shoot very well, they couldn't clear a house, they couldn't skydive, whatever those were. And it didn't make sense because these were experienced dudes, you know, and they'd already done a lot of this, right? So it was dissatisfying for us, it was dissatisfying for our leadership, but more importantly, it was dissatisfying for them, for the person getting deselected, because it's never good to hear that you don't have what it takes. And so, and just from a community standpoint, and again, you and the listeners who know the community will understand, it was having somewhat of a negative effect on the relationship between our particular command and the rest of the community, because we weren't giving good reasons, right? So I know I got in there, my CO said, hey, see if you can articulate this a little bit better. And what I needed to do is I needed to break down performance and say, okay, what is performance? And all I could do was kind of go back to our basics, which is BUDS. And if you go all the way back, it's, you know, it's Draper Kaufman on the beaches of I guess, Fort Pierce doing Hell Week, right, for the UDT. But ultimately, just to kind of give a more recent anecdote, I would say that I thought, as I was thinking about it, I said to myself, okay, when I was going through BUDS, when we were going through BUDS, we spent hundreds of hours running around with heavy boats on our heads and hundreds of hours exercising with 300-pound telephone poles and running around with those damn things and freezing in the surf zone. And then I looked at my career and I had done hundreds of combat missions overseas, and I'd done thousands of training evolutions. Never on one of them did I carry a boat on my head or a 300-pound telephone pole, right? So what they were doing to us in BUDS when they were doing that was not training us in the skills to be Navy SEALs. They were basically putting us into situations to tease out innate qualities inherent to our being that told them if we had what it took to be SEALs. And so this is where I began to say, okay, we need to separate performance. A lot of times performance is measured and assessed by skills, right? And skills are different than these innate qualities. And so just to kind of break it down, skills are not inherent to our nature, right? We're not born with the ability to ride a bike or shoot a gun or drive a car. Skills direct behavior. They tell us when and how to do something, shoot a gun, ride a bike, drive a car. And then because they're kind of didactic and visible, they're very easy to assess, measure, and test. You can see how well anybody does any one of those things. And you can score it, and you can put stats around it, and you can put it on a resume, okay? This is why usually when businesses or groups or organizations are building teams, they get seduced by skills, because it's very easy to see, assess, and measure. This is where dream team stuff comes from, right? Oh, get the best person. What skills don't tell us, though, is how we can operate and how we're going to operate in stress, challenge, and uncertainty. Because in an unknown environment, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to apply a known skill, right? So this is when we begin to lean on our attributes. All of us are, so attributes are innate, okay? All of us are born with levels of patience, adaptability, situational awareness, okay? Attributes inform our behavior rather than dictate our behavior. So my son's levels of adaptability and perseverance and resilience, for example, informed the way he showed up when he was learning the skill of riding a bike and he was falling off a dozen times. So they inform our behavior rather than dictate. And then because they're hidden in the background, they're difficult to assess, measure, and test. You can't see how patient or adaptable someone is just by sitting across an interview table and interviewing them, right? They show up in times of challenge, uncertainty, and stress, which is why the environments we found ourselves in, both in training and running training, were perfect laboratories. And so once I began to separate this, we began to say, okay, we are actually looking for these innate qualities, these attributes. Certainly skills matter, but when we're building teams like this, if we want to understand how a team's going to operate when things go bad, we need to understand what attributes we're looking for. And so the book really breaks down, and I break down 25 attributes in the book. The attributes in the book, so there are more than 25 attributes, okay? I basically took the 25. What I did is I took the list I originally had when I was running this process, which was a list of 36. I looked at it again. I had to concede that there were still a couple skills on there that I hadn't seen before. And then I said, well, what are very SEAL-specific ones that shouldn't be on a list that needs to be ubiquitous? Because as I had no interest in writing a SEAL book, you know. I wanted to write a book that was, you know, for and about the reader. So those 25 really kind of, I felt like, were the more ubiquitous ones that spoke to performance on a holistic level. And then it was cool because as I wrote the book, they began naturally binning into these categories that made it even kind of, made it even fit together even more. So ultimately, the categories of grit, what are the attributes that make up? Because again, people make the mistake and assumption that grit is its own attribute, and it's not. Angela Duckworth, who you mentioned, she wrote a book called Grit that says that, you know, says that, hey, it's not just one thing. So what are the attributes that make up grit? What are the attributes that make up mental acuity, which is how our brain processes and views and operates in the world? What are the attributes that make up drive, you know, our ability to kind of set, pursue, and achieve long-term goals? And then the attributes of great leadership and the attributes of great team ability. And then I have a few others that I wrote about too, kind of that had different polarities. But that's kind of how it kind of got put together. And it was really fun to do because I really hadn't thought about them in the fidelity that I needed to for the book until I began writing about them, which was cool.
What mistakes do you see leaders in the private sector make when they're building teams in terms of assembling the right people? So there's a few different concepts that we've alluded to so far. One is the way people mesh together. The other is the unique blend of attributes and degrees or scales, or you mentioned the dimmer switch metaphor, yeah, which I like. And so they've got those unique things. And I think about this in terms of mapping a mission, a culture, the leadership you have in place, the team members to that, and then with each other.
Yeah.
Rather than maybe go, you could probably talk forever, and you kind of do in the book, about maybe how to do that in a positive sense. What are the key mistakes you've seen people make in trying to build these dream teams?
Yeah, well, the first very obvious one is they don't consider attributes at all, right? I mean, they just base it on skills. We've seen this time and time again. It's like we're going to get the best this, best that, best, you know. And, you know, I in doing some of this research, in doing the research when I was actually running the selection training, I came across this guy named Russell Acuff, and he's a behavioral psychologist and systems analyst and things like that. He's deceased now. But he used to talk about how systems and organizations work. And he would say, he'd basically ask a crowd, he said, hey, if I were to take the best parts of every best automobile, right? So, for example, if the BMW has the best steering column, if the Jeep has the best suspension, if the Jaguar has the best engine, whatever, you name it, whatever those are, and put all those best parts together, would I have the best vehicle in the world? And the answer is no, you wouldn't have a vehicle because the parts wouldn't fit. And he used to say the performance and success of a system is never the sum of its parts. It's the product of their interaction, right? And so it goes with humans and so it goes with teams. And when you talk about interaction between human beings, you're not talking about skills anymore. Okay, interaction between human beings is mostly attributes. It's things like empathy. It's things like integrity. It's things like conscientiousness. All these things that we typically, as we build teams, we don't take into account. So people often make the mistake when they're building teams of trying to build the best automobile on the planet or in the world or in their business by taking the best parts of everything and mashing them together. And that's not how it works. And so I think that's the biggest mistake. And the other mistake people make is, assuming that maybe they're thinking about attributes, is they don't consider what their list of attributes looks like for their particular team. The list of attributes that's required to be a good Navy SEAL for you and I is going to look different than the list of attributes required to be a great accountant or teacher or you name it. All right. So this is why I typically disagree with some of these programs. Again, there's some good ones, there's some bad ones. I'm not gonna name names or call anybody out because I honestly don't know enough about it. But any of these programs that take a military setting, take business people into a military setting and throw them into military type environments to do like team building or figure out, hey, who has what it takes. They're not contextual. Like, I'm not gonna learn anything about what makes a great accounting team by throwing them in the surf zone in San Diego, right? Well, see how well they do in the cold, and we might get some clues as to how they might do in SEAL training, but it's not going to teach us anything about how they do in accounting. So I think the mistake is not considering attributes up front, and also if you start thinking about attributes, not considering your own unique list of attributes and the contextual environments and situations inside of which you can see them and tease them out.
Yeah, I love your mention of empathy there, and you say in the book how empathy wasn't really emphasized in the military. You also pay attention to listening in the book as well, which I don't ever remember anyone at the Naval Academy, on the ship, in the teams, ever. No mentor ever advised me to listen better.
Yeah.
And even by example, I think I could probably count on one hand the people who stand out as leaders who actually listened actively. And I only realized that in retrospect with, some hindsight and a little bit of wisdom over the years and seeing the value in that. It's a shame it's not emphasized more. I love that. Yeah.
Well, the Academy and the ROTC units and the military holistically makes a mistake. And it's a mistake that every military service makes. And it's understandable, but they make the mistake of telling future officers that they are going to be leaders. Okay. No, that's incorrect. They are going to be in charge. They will be put into positions of being in charge of people. It's up to that individual as to whether or not they are going to behave in a way that allows people to think of them as leaders. And you and I know this personally, right? There are leaders we can think of and hold in our minds right now, there are senior officers who we experienced in our careers who we can think of and picture in our face who we can say to ourselves, like, without a doubt, that person I never considered a leader. That person was in charge, right? And then there are other people we can think of and say, that person was a leader. And it doesn't actually have to be the person in charge. You and I, in the teams, you experience it all the time. It could be the E5 who's in charge of breaching. And that guy, like, that's the guy you go to every time because that guy behaves like a leader behaves. So leadership and being in charge are two different things. One's a noun, one's a verb. And I think a lot of organizations, to include the military, don't effectively make that distinction. They conflate them too often and too much. And it sometimes, unfortunately, makes people believe that their rank qualifies them as a leader. And it certainly does not.
Hey, gang. Hope you're enjoying this episode of The Warrior Poet. If you are, don't forget to subscribe so I can get you more thoughts on leadership, interviews with military experts and business phenoms, as well as other hacks to up your game in your daily life. And please leave a review. Let me know what I'm doing well, which interviews you'd like, and if you like the philosophical musings, footnotes, mentions of music from times past. Back to the show.
Yeah, I love the way you wrote it in the book. I highlighted it in my Kindle highlights. My rank made me a boss, not a leader.
Yeah.
Can you talk about drivers versus leaders? I've experienced both, just like you have. I think in startups, in technology, in finance, some of the industries that I've been a part of, at least to some degree, it's very heavy on the drivers, and people conflate that really badly, those two concepts. And I don't know if it relates or not. I think it was a different part of the book, but I love the anecdote you gave of Stalin, who, you know, was the ultimate driver, was the ultimate boss, but not the consummate leader by any degree. When push came to shove, when the rubber met the road, like all the cliches there, could not actually make a decision and was paralyzed. And I have seen that pattern in a lot of drivers, not all, but many. What do you think it is that so many people continue to confuse those two things?
Yeah, because I think it's fun to be a driver. It's fun to be in charge. It's fun to be in control. I love driving. You know, I give me anything to drive. I love doing it, right? You know, I'm in control. I'm taking the wheel. I'm steering. I'm accelerating. I'm braking, okay? The problem is that when you're leading human beings, you are, in fact, you're not dealing with machines. You're not dealing with machinery, right? The drive thinks of those people in his or her span of care as a machine, okay? It's basically a vehicle that they are in charge of. They are in control. They have the vision. They're taking that machine to where they want to go. Every person is simply a lever or a button or a pedal to push or pull or do what needs to be done to make that vehicle go. If a button is pushed and it doesn't work, the button gets replaced, okay? That's how the driver thinks, all right? The leader understands differently. The leader understands that the organization is not a series of parts. It's not a machine. It's a living and it's a breathing organism that can and will either kind of atrophy and die from low morale or lack of purpose or lack of inspiration, or can actually grow and flourish and become something bigger and better beyond what that person in charge ever thought it could be. In other words, you can create an organism that outgrows and outruns the leader, which is really the ultimate charge, the ultimate job of a leader. And I used to tell this to my JOs. I said, to do this job right, you have to realize the irony of leadership. The irony of leadership is if you do your job right, you work yourself out of a job eventually, right? You create an organism, you create a system that can operate without you, and in some cases begins to outrun you, right? That's what every leader actually should be striving to do. And I remember being, you know, having young JOs come through the selection process or interviewing guys coming in who are younger than me, whether it be for the selection process rerunning or guys who wanted to go to Buds or guys just coming in, and sometimes looking at these guys and listening to these guys and thinking, oh my God, this guy is so much better than me. And it got me excited, right? It really did. When I had, like, I was CO and I had troop commanders, my troop commanders when I was CO were just so phenomenal. They were so much better than me. And it was exciting to me because I was like, man, look at these guys go. They will overtake me so fast, it's going to make my head spin. And it made me excited. And I think if you're not a leader or a person in charge who thinks that, then you're probably a driver because you're going to want to keep control. You're going to take control. You will not concede your own obsolescence. And your vehicle, whatever you want to describe, will only go as fast as you think you can take it. And by the way, it's not going to go that fast because the governor on that engine is you, right? You need to, the best leader. And here's the other part of the problem with the word leader is that the noun version of leader implies someone in front. And we always hear this lead from the front, all this stuff. Well, we all know the best leaders that we've ever experienced, the best leaders on the planet, they're not in front, right? They're usually actually in the back. They're pushing, they're empowering, they're inspiring. They're causing their people to grow and become better, right? Those are the best leaders we've ever experienced.
100%. The people who don't worry about the limelight, that sort of stuff. I think I've experienced it. Anyone who works in the private sector for any period of time obviously experiences it when you make a proposal or you do all the heavy lifting, right? And then your boss goes into the meeting and presents all of your work as if you're not even there. And I think there's a degree of self-assurance and comfort with who you are as a leader, as an individual, that maybe allows people to outshine or to get the limelight. At least that's my hypothesis, whereas those who feel the need to drive to always be the one with the right answer, to be the smartest guy in the room, gal in the room, are maybe lacking some of that confidence, self-esteem. I see you nodding your head. So it seems like we're roughly on the same page. Yeah. Where I was going with this, though, is can you talk a little bit about ego, narcissism? I love how some of your attributes are ones that maybe are counterintuitive to most people, but having, you know, lived buds like you have and the teams and elsewhere, you know, I can fully agree that there's an element of, I want to be that badass, yeah, right? Like, that's why I'm doing this, you know, freezing my ass off in the middle of the night, you know, with my new best friends here. You know, it's largely because of that, because you're not shooting, you know, weapons, doing cool shit and buds, like, right, not at all, right? It's about that dream of being that person. So would love to hear your thoughts on that. And for me, Warrior Poet listeners know how much I like Ryan Holiday and his work, especially Ego is the Enemy. I haven't tattooed that on my forearms like him yet, but I may do so yet. So, you know, how can people grow in this area? What do they need to keep in mind?
Yeah, well, here's what I was saying. I love Ryan Holiday's work as well, and I love that book. But before you tattoo anything, consider this, okay? Because I'm really into semantics. I think semantics and understanding the meanings of words helps us clarify, helps bring. And I think ego gets a bad rap, okay? Ego is simply sense of self, all right? That's all it is. And all of us, every single conscious human being has a sense of oneself, right? That is ego. Now, when we start talking about inflated ego, that's when you start getting like arrogance, right? But you can have, we all have ego. You can have arrogance, which is inflated ego. You can have confidence, okay, which is like, hey, I know and I'm confident what I'm capable for. That's it. That in some cases is a little bit of an inflated ego, but just in a positive metabolization, right? So really we need to think about it in terms of confidence versus arrogance versus just ego. Because if you are egoless, then you are like a Buddha, right? I mean, that's like that you've disassociated yourself with all other. I mean, you are now one with everything, which is, that's okay too. Okay. But let's, you know, in our real lives, we have to understand that ego, sense of self. Confidence and arrogance are unique. And actually, I think better ways to explain this, because confidence is, I know I can do this. Arrogance is, I'm better than you. Okay. Confidence is internally focused. Arrogance is externally expressed, okay? Confidence is quiet, arrogance is loud. Arrogance, the externally expressed inflated ego, I guess we could say, is usually I'd normally say always, but I try to stay away from those, you know, those definitive words, right? But I would say almost always a result of some sort of self-esteem insecurity issue, right? The reason why anybody wants or needs or feels the desire to externally express their expertise or their knowledge or whatever is because they are lacking in some other area. They need some sort of infusion of attention, of adoration, of whatever that is. So that's where we have to be careful: arrogance and confidence. Narcissism, I kind of put in a different bin, and that's why I talked about it in terms of an attribute. Narcissism is simply the desire to be recognized, to stand out, to be adored, okay? To be paid attention to, all right? Well, guess what? Every human being on the planet at some point in their lives wants to stand out, be recognized, be adored, be paid attention to. And the reason is because it's a biological thing, right? When we're being paid attention to and adored, we are getting bursts of chemicals, neurotransmitters and hormones, right? We're getting bursts of dopamine, we're getting bursts of serotonin, getting bursts of oxytocin. These are all feel-good bonding chemicals. That doesn't change when we're adults. It feels good to be adored, be stand out once in a while. So narcissism metabolized appropriately can be and often is the inception of some audacious goals. I mean, you and I, when we were young kids or teenagers, whenever the decision was made, who said, I want to be a Navy SEAL, that's a little bit of narcissism going on there. Because again, I joke, and I know you're going to agree with this, because we can ask anyone, it can ask any SEAL on the planet. And if you ask any SEAL on the planet, why did you become a Navy SEAL? If they say patriotism as their first answer, we know they're not telling us the truth, okay? certainly we're patriots and certainly we love our country. Most of us, almost all of us, wanted to see if we could do it. On some level, we wanted to be badasses, okay? There's nothing wrong with that. Metabolized in a healthy way, it caused us to do what we did, right? So I think narcissism is one of those attributes that you can use very, very effectively in the drive of a goal. Now, it comes with caution, right? Because narcissistic personality disorder is, in fact, a disorder. Narcissism also is dangerous because it's almost impossible to see in ourselves. It's like a vampire staring in the mirror, right? So if it gets overboard, it's hard to see. So we have to surround ourselves with people who give us the truth, who tell us the truth, who give us the candor with care that we need, tell us our grounding wires, that tell us when we're getting out over our skis. And this is the idea. I mean, this is kind of goes back to what we originally said. When you continue to surround yourself with people who you feel are better than you, and you have a little bit of a fear of imposter syndrome going on, it helps inoculate you from narcissism. It helps inoculate you from arrogance, because it's that constant reminder is, hey, I need to make sure that I'm doing what I need to do and not a fraud, right? And you're keeping yourself humble. It's an active kind of expression, or actually a journey of humility, right? And so I think just ego, confidence, arrogance, and narcissism all have to be kind of taken apart and thought about in ways that are actually helpful versus just broadly defined.
I love that explanation of the interplay between the attributes and other traits and how they balance each other out. And you do that really well in the book, but it's great to hear that out loud. Perhaps to segue from narcissism, there might be an element in certain parts of the book or any self-improvement literature that someone reads to try and, you know, pick out the things that they want to be or they want to work on. You know, the same could be said of assessments, right? You talk a little about confidence in the book, or sorry, competitiveness mm-hmm. in the book, and how you weren't particularly competitive in high school sports and that subsequently in the teams, whereas the kind of portrayal of team guys is that they're constantly competitive all the time. And guys in Buds, I remember instructors even talking about training trips where you're waiting around out somewhere, maybe at a mobility trip in the middle of the desert, and you know, guys are like throwing rocks at bottles and stuff just to like pass the time and see who can win and taking bets. So in that narcissistic kind of picking what you think the portrayal should be, there's a passage in the book where you talk about those who truly aren't constrained by the thoughts of others, who sincerely enjoy separating themselves from the herd. So, you know, in that competitive sphere, like, how can I win? Like, how can I win the book? How can I win the assessment, right? I'm sort of like, well, like, yeah, I definitely want to be the one who's truly not constrained by the thoughts of others, especially when you mentioned Steve Jobs, Richard Feynman, Vincent Van Gogh. I feel like, you know, why should that not be my top attribute I work on? You know, where do you see that playing well, that particular attribute there? I can't remember exactly which one it is, because I can see that attribute at high levels in the dimmer switch actually not doing that well in a corporate environment, right?
Yeah.
That might not be the best middle manager in an accounting department. You know, maybe that's somebody else. What are you doing there?
Well, so those three that I talk about at the end of the book, and the chapter I call the others, were three, I guess ultimately six attributes that weren't binning properly in those categories. Because if we look at the categories and the attributes inside the cat, for the most part, you can say having more of it is better. Okay. Obviously having too much of anything is bad, but for the most part, having a lot of being high on adaptability, high on courage, high on resilience is good. Yeah. Narcissism perhaps being the one exception. Right. But that's the idea. When I started looking at competitiveness, which is an attribute, and I started looking at, you know, fear of rejection, and I started looking at patience, for example, I said to myself, well, and I kind of in the research, I said, well, yes, having a lot of competitiveness is certainly an attribute of some very high achievers, but but being non-competitive is also an attribute of some very high achievers, right? These are our iconoclasts, these people who really, They don't look at a field of a bunch of people competing and say, I want to jump into the fray. They say, I don't want any part of that. What's something I can do differently? These are the disruptors of the world, right? So So both polarities are actually very powerful in performance and optimal performance. And what I noticed at Buds especially is that both polarities are recognized and rewarded at Buds, right? You have two awards at the end of the Buds. You have the honor man, which ultimately is the guy who did the best at the O courses and the runs and the swims, got all the highest scores, the most competitive person, right? And then you have the fire in the gut, right? Which is actually the person often who did the worst. That's the one that the instructors and the students vote on, the guy who showed the most grit, the drive, who powered through, who struggled the most, right? And often had the worst scores, right? So it became quite obvious, especially when we got into the job and we were out in the combat zone. And you realize that sometimes missions require looking at it competitively. Look at, okay, how can we run up the line on this one? You know, we're going to go straight in, run up the line and hit the target, right? But a lot of times it was like, okay, well, how can we do something that no one's ever expecting? Kind of think about it differently. So the competitive person, the person high on competitive is vastly important when it comes to understanding a problem and understanding all the rules and boundaries inside of a problem, game, or whatever situation, and saying, I am going to win in that environment. Okay, that's the competitive mind. Very important in a team. But also important in a team is the non-competitive person who sees all of that and says, I have no interest in that. What's a different way we can do it, right? And to have both of those polarities on team is really, really powerful. And so those were and same thing with fear of rejection. I care what people think to the extent that it's going to push me to do things. I mean, I didn't like heights. Jumping out of airplanes was always hard for me, right? Why did I do it? Well, because every other guy was doing it. So there was no way I'm going to let everybody down, right? I'm not going to be rejected. I'm not going to let everybody, I'm going to do it, right? So fear of rejection can push us in ways that we haven't been pushed before. But those people who don't care what other people think and do their own thing, again, the iconoclasts of the world, who say, you know what, I don't give a crap what anybody thinks, I'm just going to do this, right? They're the people, they're the groundbreakers oftentimes, so the people who do things and then they create their own pack around them, you know? That's important too. And of course, patience and impatience. There are highly patient, highly successful people, and there are highly successful people who are highly impatient, right? So having those polarities helps too. And I always, for that one, I always use my wife and I, who consider a high-performing team, right? Because we've been married for 20 years, have two kids who are teenagers now. I am a very patient, and she is a very impatient person, right? When patience has been required in our marriage, in our lives, I step up and take lead. When impatience is required, she steps up. And there are so many situations where my patience would have delayed action in a way that would have been detrimental. Her impatience needed to be there, right? And there are other situations where if we had been impatient, it would have been detrimental. My patience taking lead helped. So to have both polarities actually helps quite a bit.
Awesome. Couple more questions here before we wrap up. You allude a little bit there in the bidirectional attributes, as well as the person who's patient, open-minded, doesn't care what other people are playing in terms of a game, the infinite game there, Simon Sinek's concept, or at least one that he developed and is known for. How do you in your own life, Rich, prioritize, given that life isn't an infinite game? So you've got this set of attributes, you've got this set of interests. How do you go about picking something that you want to do? And also, how do you insist with Simon that Empire Strikes Back is better than Rogue One? Because that's preposterous. Rogue One is the best one of the franchise.
Oh, okay. Okay. Let me take the first question first, because the first question is way easier. But all right, how do I prioritize? You know, I feel so grateful. I feel so fortunate. I think you feel the same way, to have embarked upon a path early in life that challenged me so deeply and gave me such fullness and richness about myself and my capabilities that, I mean, I feel like I'm someone, and I'm 47, so I got a long time left, right? But I feel like I'm someone who really has nothing to prove to anybody, right? Which means I can pretty much decide what I want to do. And as long as it's in support of my family, and so those people I love and support, we're good, right? And so at this point, it's kind of like, hey, what am I interested in? What's my next... What am I passionate about? What am I interested in? And what's the next audacious goal that I can set, you know, for myself? And that will ultimately benefit people. I think, you know, people, again, we served in the military, so I know, and people, it's very cool because a lot of people always thank us for our service, and I really appreciate that. And I understand we are in a profession of service, but in some cases, my SEAL this, my SEAL life was selfish as well. It certainly was when it, you know, started to talk about my family. I mean, my kids missed, I missed a lot of my kids growing up. They missed a lot of me. It was hard for them. It's hard for my wife. So there was a selfishness there. So I think my next thing is I'm now at home. I get to work from home. My wife and I work together now. My boys are teenagers. I get to spend time. So these decisions and these next goals, I think, come from those standpoints. And I think that's how I progress. So that's number one. Number two, again, we're very subjective people, my friend, but ultimately Star Wars is the story of the Skywalker, and specifically Anakin Skywalker, right? And Darth Vader Darth Vader at his finest, I believe, is Empire Strikes Back. I just think that's, we don't see Darth Vader. Now, again, I will concede the end of Rogue One is probably one of the most spectacular Star Wars scenes ever created, right? When Darth Vader is doing his thing. But again, that's Darth Vader. I love Empire because it's mostly Darth Vader, and it's just Darth Vader at his finest and most badass, I think. So there you go. That's my opinion.
Fair enough. I mean, you make a good point about the arc of the storyline. I do think that Darth Vader scene at the end of Rogue One is amazing. I just love the characters, and I like the espionage element, and I like, most of all, the story of sacrifice in that is just so poignant. But
it's a very well done, very well done movie, I have to say.
So. Reasonable people can disagree.
Yeah.
Well, Rich, it's been phenomenal having you on. Really appreciate you taking the time here. The book really was uniquely amazing. So thanks for putting it out there. Congratulations on getting it out there. What final words of wisdom, ask for the audience, do you have?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'd love, I want to just make sure everybody understands this is not a SEAL book. You know, this is a book that is really ultimately about the reader. And so if you are interested in kind of learning a little bit about your own engine and how you operate in the world, I would encourage you to take a look. You can, I also have some assessments on the website that people can take for free. They can see where they stand on some of these attributes. So do that. But ultimately, I encourage anybody just to go out and explore their potential. And the only way, you alluded to it right at the beginning with growth mindset stuff, the only way to effectively explore your potential is by definition what could be, right? It's not what is, right? And so the only way you can explore what could be is to walk out to those edges and look over the side and start getting out there, right? It's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be scary, but that's the only way to do it. And once you do it, you're going to find a reward that's just unimaginable. So go out and explore your edges is what I'd encourage.
Well said, Rich. Thanks again, and keep on doing great things.
No, thanks. Thanks for having me, brother. It's been great.
If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Shri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Shri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shri.
No, Kevin. Mina Dua. Spita.